May it please the court. This court should reverse the trial court's decision below because, in this instance, Vincent McFadden's post-conviction action reflects a lack of fundamental due process and really the kind of arbitrariness that the Eighth Amendment prohibits. In the situation, we had the judge conduct a motion with only two of the jurors present when we were trying to determine juror misconduct as to the entire jurors who sat in the alternates. By limiting the scope of that hearing, we did not get to hear from the other jurors. It is fundamentally unfair when you're trying to litigate a juror misconduct claim to limit it in the way the court did. In fact, the court used the language that Judge Goldman said that he had the court administrator randomly select one other juror besides Williams. This randomness is just exactly what the Eighth Amendment forbids. It's arbitrariness, and that's what this hearing was. It was arbitrarily conducted. What is equally problematic is after this two-person hearing was conducted is that Judge Goldman disqualified himself because of contacts that he had with the prosecutor about Vincent's two capital trials and his post-conviction action on the assault case. So he had acquired extrajudicial knowledge of cases involving Vincent, yet he ended up being post-conviction.
Well, to be fair, he said he didn't know if he may have discussed it. He didn't say he actually remembered it or had extrajudicial knowledge.
He said he wasn't sure if he remembered discussing it, but he did say that it was his practice to have discussions with Mr. Larner about issues in Mr. Larner's cases. And Mr. Larner testified that he and Judge Goldman had discussed the facts of Vincent's case, and in talking to Judge Goldman, he had talked about some of the highlights of the case. Now, certainly when this...
Now, you all disagree on that. So you say specifically remembered doing that, or just it was likely he did that? Because I thought the state said he just said it was likely he would have, but there wasn't a...
Larner testified that he did actually talk about, he referred to it as some of the highlights of the case. He would have done it. He was confident that he had discussed the facts of the case with Judge Goldman. I think his testimony is very clear on that, that there were discussions specifically about Vincent McFadden's two capital retrials and also his assault case, which Mr. Larner handled a post-conviction on. And that was the testimony of Mr. Larner. And Judge Goldman said that Mr. Larner, he discussed cases about the issues that were presented in those cases that Mr. Larner was on. So he has this extrajudicial knowledge of Vincent McFadden's three cases that we're essentially talking about that Mr. Larner represented the state on.
And how would that affect the jury selection issue?
Well, it affects the issue of the fairness of the hearing. I mean, if Judge Goldman has acquired facts outside having served on Vincent McFadden's cases, that's extrajudicial knowledge. And he, on his own, disqualified himself because there was the appearance of unfairness. And I think when you look at the hearing, there really is a question about the appearance of unfairness when you see that the scope is limited to two jurors, and then there's credibility findings. Can these credibility findings be relied on, or are they based upon things that Mr. Larner and his conversations that he had with Judge Goldman influenced the kinds of determinations that were made as to these credibility findings?
How is our decision on that influenced by the fact that two of the later judges, I think maybe three, refused to allow additional interviews of jurors? Does that negate any of the bias, or does it still remain?
I think the bias is still problematic. I think those subsequent judges had a duty to redo the hearing for multiple reasons. One, because the original hearing was limited to two jurors. It needed to be redone for that reason. Secondly, Judge Goldman had disqualified himself, so effectively, that hearing was a nullity. It was as though it had never occurred. He couldn't fairly sit, and he disqualified himself. So for that reason, they had to redo the hearing and include the 12 jurors who sat and the alternates. So there's also a problem with those jurors, those subsequent judges, relying on what took place with Judge Goldman, in that they did not see these two jurors who did testify to be able to make credibility findings. Those credibility findings were Judge Goldman's findings. They didn't see these jurors come in and testify. So for all those reasons, the subsequent judges could not rely on what had taken place in front of Judge Goldman.
Was the hearing even required after this court determined that there was no jury nondisclosure issue?
This court did not say that. This court said that there were assumptions that Mr. Williams engaged in misconduct. So there's a claim pled that there was jury misconduct, and it goes to Williams' conduct of having been on this assault case and acquired knowledge that was specific to the assault case, and whether or not having that knowledge, whether he conveyed it to other jurors who sat on the Addison, this case, trial. So this court did not dispose of it. It actually, I think, set up the legal issue that was included in the pleadings, that there was juror misconduct and it had to be proven. And that's what post-conviction counsel was trying to do, was to prove the juror misconduct claim.
But I mean, it was like 9 years in between the two trials. I mean, isn't that plausible that the juror did actually have no memory? Isn't that plausible?
It's plausible, but we need a fact finder who can make that determination after hearing all the jurors as well as Juror Williams. I don't think we can assume that. That was his testimony, that he didn't have any recollection, but I think that needs to be done in the context of a full and complete hearing where you have the 12 jurors, the alternates, and you have all of them, because maybe other jurors will come in and say, you know, what he said isn't true.
I mean, you're raising two different issues. One is, was the hearing adequate with Judge Goldman because of his later recusal? Did it need to be redone? The second is that I think you're saying, in effect, it's an abuse of discretion not to let counsel interview all 12 jurors and alternates too, from what I recall the request was below. Is there any case that says that? That goes a lot further than anything I recall seeing.
Judge, I think this is a very novel situation where you have, in fact, appellate counsel on the direct appeal was the one who brought it to this court's attention after much effort to do it. It really could have been brought to the attention by the trial attorneys and they could have got this out.
But is there any case that says, the court here said, okay, I'll let you talk to the person, I'll let you talk to someone else, but you're saying it was an abuse of discretion not to let you interview every juror. Is there precedent for that, saying that would be an abuse of discretion in this or in any kind of situation?
When you say every juror, I mean the petit jury.
Yeah, I was talking about the veneer issue. I'm not talking about the veneer issue.
I'm not aware of a case from this court or any court that's dealt with that. I think the closest is the Post case, where they went back and they interviewed lots of jurors, is my understanding from that opinion.
And courts can let you, but we would have to hold, if we held in your favor on this issue, that it's an abuse of discretion for a court not to let you interview every juror or alternate when the issue is, did someone talk to them about an inappropriate issue?
I mean, I don't think it would be every case, but I think this case lends itself to that because of the unusual facts. The unusual facts of, I mean, it's just sort of, in some ways, mind-boggling that this juror was coincidentally on the assault case and then subsequently ends up being a juror on the capital case. So, I mean, I think in this case, this court should find that the hearing that was held was not adequate, but all because Judge Goldman had to be disqualified, he disqualified himself. But also, to really, it really strikes of what the Supreme Court has talked about in terms of like being struck by lightning. If you're only taking two of the jurors and not all of them who sat, you're really not getting the true perspective on what took place. You're getting two people's perspectives, and not, you're ignoring the other 10 and the two alternates who may have information to share. I think it's particularly problematic in this case in terms of him having served on the assault case, because during that voir dire, he acquired information that the Addison case people didn't get. On that voir dire, he was told that there were three assault cases and three ACA cases. Ultimately, Vincent McFadden was acquitted on one of those assault cases and that ACA count, and it was done by the trial judge. So Mr. Williams had more information going into this than what the jury ultimately heard in the Addison case. I think it was particularly problematic for Williams also to have knowledge that this was a shooting into a minivan, because I think it conjures up all kinds of images for people. He was shooting at a minivan. Were there children involved? Were there adults with supervising children? There are lots of things that Williams took away from the assault case that he brought to this case. And there was only approximately 3 years between the assault case and the trial of the Addison case. So there isn't 9 years. There's 9 years between when the Addison case was tried and when we're talking now, but there was only approximately 3 years between the assault case and the retrial of the Addison case.
Well, I mean, if we found intentional non-disclosure, then you don't have to show prejudice, do you? But if, but it, But intentional nondisclosure couldn't be found unless he remembered it. And if he didn't remember it, then none of these influences would have been there. It all hooks on whether it was intentional, whether he actually remembered it. Because if he didn't, then he wouldn't have had any of this knowledge.
The intentional does depend on that having occurred. But I think the door is still left open for an unintentional disclosure. I don't think that should be totally...
But if it was unintentional, it would have to mean he didn't remember it, right?
Right. But I'm not... The claim is pled as an intentional disclosure, and we don't have to show prejudice.
Right, exactly.
And that's what this court said on direct appeal, is that if it's intentional, which we're trying to prove here. Now, his testimony... was that he didn't remember. But that testimony needed to be by a judge who could fairly sit and serve and judge his credibility. It was Judge Goldman judging his credibility, and he took himself off the case. And that, in effect, I think, renders his credibility findings null and void because he said, I can't judge this. And he had that basis for not being able to judge before.
And on that issue, you're saying there should be a new hearing before a new judge who can judge his credibility?
Right. There should be a hearing before a new judge that judges his credibility, but also it is a hearing that needs to be done with all 12 jurors and the alternates who sat on the jury. We can't have a judge who says, who holds a hearing and then says, I really need to disqualify myself because I may have acquired, and probably did, based upon the prosecutor's testimony, he did acquire extrajudicial knowledge, making credibility findings about a juror and whether that juror committed juror misconduct.
If there was going to be a hearing to inquire a former member of the jury and this particular juror, wouldn't it have been more appropriate that that hearing occurred after the trial, before judgment was entered, or that it was abuse of discretion not to have that hearing and argued on appeal?
Judge, it didn't come to attention until this case was on appeal, on direct appeal. It was the appellate attorney on direct appeal who got this information. What happened was at trial, Mr. McFadden told his trial attorneys, hey, I recognize this guy. They did nothing with it. But when it got to appeal, counsel on appeal supplemented the legal file, and this court basically adopted and agreed that they were one and the same. So there really wasn't the opportunity to litigate this below.
But that's one of your claims of ineffectiveness, is that trial counsel did not pursue it. And so you missed out on that, and that's one of your claims in your
right. And we're really, I've argued that we proved it, but if we haven't proved it, it's because we didn't get the chance to talk to these jurors. And that's critical, to get to talk to all of them to see whether there was any sort of disclosure of what took place on the assault case, the Brian Burns case.
Your claim is not that it was error, but that it was a constitutional violation of both due process and the Eighth Amendment to deny the discovery and the hearing involving all of the jurors and alternates. Is that right?
Well, it's error and it's constitutional error. That's how it's framed. It's both. I mean, it is error of the trial court, but it goes to fundamental fairness when you only get to question two of the jurors, and it's arbitrary under the Eighth Amendment because, Judge Goldman used the exact word of, I think, that mirrors arbitrary. So when he said it was the selection of this Ellsworth juror was done randomly, and random was the word that he chose to use by the court administrator to do that when the foreperson was summoned for this hearing.
But so I'm clear, you're not saying there was an Eighth Amendment violation in the underlying trial or the underlying judgment and sentence, but that the violation occurred in the motion court, in the hearing, and the preparation for the hearing.
Right. The arguments go to what took place in front of the motion court because that's where this hearing was held. It wasn't held at trial, at the trial level, because it was done before the 2915 motion court, exactly.
Have we ever said that the Eighth Amendment polices the conduct of the motion court in a PCR?
I think the Eighth Amendment is, whether it's a direct appeal or post-conviction action, those are always the case. It's applicable no matter what context you're talking about. At trial, on post-conviction, the Eighth Amendment is always there over any case, and it's applicable. It's not just because you're on post-conviction, the Eighth Amendment somehow is taken out of the case. It's still at play.
But we ordinarily are arguing about whether the underlying conviction violates the Eighth Amendment, not whether some ruling or another of the motion court violated the Eighth Amendment.
I wouldn't say that it's ordinarily the case. I think it's I think it's done in both circumstances. I think it's done in trial. I think it's done in post-conviction. I know my claims are always framed on post-conviction in terms of due process and the Eighth Amendment, because throughout, that is what is at
the end. Well, you are saying it affected the trial because you said you believe an unqualified juror sat who already had a bias based upon pre-existing knowledge that they failed to disclose, and you were entitled to have them stricken. So you're saying it affected the fairness of the underlying trial.
It's not just
an esoteric Eighth Amendment argument.
No, it's not. I mean, it impacted the trial because there was a juror who could not fairly serve. I mean, so it goes to both. I mean, we're proving up the trial claim in the context of the post-conviction action is what we're doing here. I've gone over my time. Unless the court has other questions, I will save anything else for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, just to follow up on the discussion that we just ended with, I think the basis of the Eighth Amendment claim is this idea of randomness, and I would just note that the cases cited in the brief regarding randomness concern randomness and how we select persons that are eligible for the death penalty. I don't think those cases carry over to the idea of randomness and how you conduct a post-conviction hearing into alleged juror misconduct. So while there might be some Eighth Amendment issues or at least underlying concerns there, I don't think that directly affects the issue of how the judge conducted the hearing in this case.
Well, what about if this court were to find, as suggested by counsel for defendant, that the judge was biased and did have outside knowledge and therefore properly had to recuse himself from the hearing, would he be entitled to a new hearing?
If the court reached that conclusion, it certainly could order a new hearing if it felt that was appropriate. If it felt, for instance, that the review by two independent judges was insufficient to determine
and,
that.
And I think what counsel's arguing is that to the extent Judge Goldman's decision was based on a credibility determination, mm-hmm. these other judges who hadn't seen what happened couldn't redo that credibility.
Well, I would liken it, I'm sorry, to what this court and the other appellate courts do all the time, is to look at the underlying record, to look at the transcript of the hearing,
to defer.
And we defer
to the credibility determination.
Exactly.
But what if you have I'm not saying he was, but what if you have a biased person making a decision on credibility?
If there's a clear showing of bias, then there might be grounds not to defer to that. But I would argue that we don't have that in this case. Judge Goldman, remember, said that he did not recall any specific conversations about this case, only that they might have occurred. It stands to reason, then, that since he had no specific knowledge at the time of his recusal, he would have had no specific knowledge at the time he conducted this hearing with the jurors just a couple of months before. Also, if he did have any prior knowledge of the case, it would not have involved any issues regarding this juror, because as has been pointed out, that issue did not even come about until direct appeal. It was unknown to the prosecutor, to the defense attorney, to the trial judge. So Judge Goldman would have had no independent knowledge of what took place in that case.
So are you saying he didn't have to recuse, or he recused because of appearance of impropriety but not actual impropriety?
I think that's correct. The appearance of impropriety was the basis that he cited, and there was certainly no evidence to show an actual impropriety. Unlike the Anderson case, which is a case I handled, where the judge freely admitted that he had conversations with the jury foreman about what happened during the deliberations in the prior case. Very direct evidence of a conflict there. We have at most the possibility of some extrajudicial communications, and the judge, I think, I would commend him for taking a very conservative approach and recusing himself, even though I don't think he necessarily was required to do so, and even though if he had not done so and I had to stand here and argue on appeal that he was correct in not doing so, I would be very comfortable in making that argument.
Would you agree with opposing counsel that a hearing, though, was required, that a hearing bringing one or more of the jurors in was necessary?
I don't know if it was required. I think it was certainly appropriate. Again, the juror contact is an issue that occurs within the discretion of the trial court. I think given this court's ruling on direct appeal that the defendant had failed to prove the claim, I can see why the judge would want to allow a hearing under those circumstances. I think it was in his discretion to do so. I also think it was in the judge's discretion to determine the scope of how that hearing would be conducted. Remember, the motion for juror contact was a motion to contact all 170 members of the veneer.
But he says in argument he narrowed that, and he quotes parts of the transcript where he did.
At a later part, there was some discussions that seemed to indicate that, although I would note that in the 2915 motion, which is where this claim was raised, the relief sought was to renew the motion to contact the entire veneer. So they seem to be going a little bit back and forth on exactly the scope of who they want to talk to. And I have a suspicion if they just questioned the veneer and nobody said anything, then maybe there would have been a request to, or I mean the Pettit jury, then maybe there would have been a request to contact everybody.
Well, assuming just for this purpose,
sure,
that it was the Pettit jury and it
right.
was narrowed, why was that, was it an abuse of discretion not to grant them permission to speak to them all?
I don't believe it was an abuse of discretion. Now, obviously, it would be within the court's discretion to allow that. But, again, once Juror Williams comes forward and says, I don't remember any of this, after this court said on direct appeal that it would be reasonable to believe that he would not remember this after the passage of years, we're basically asking for a presumption that Juror Williams is a liar, which is somewhat the same presumption that was being indulged in on the direct appeal case. There's no reason to think that testimony was not credible, and there's no reason to discard Judge Goldman's credibility determination, because I don't think there's any basis to find that his credibility determination was in any way influenced by a conversation that may have occurred that would have, again, had nothing to do with Juror Williams' issues that were not known at the time of the trial. And again, a ruling that was reviewed by two other judges who could look at the transcript, look at the testimony, judge the appropriateness of the questions and the answers, find there was no reason to upset the findings that had already been made in those particular hearings. I thought you had a question, Judge Russell. But
no.
Okay. I would also point out, I thought I had something else to go to, but I don't think so. So unless the court has questions, though, we'd ask that the judgment of the motion court be affirmed. Thank you.
I'd like to address the issue of the bias here. In Mr. Larner's deposition, he testified as follows. But he, and he is referring to Judge Goldman, is someone I would have to say I probably very well talked to about the facts of the case back in 07 and 08, and then after the trial, what some of the highlights were. He made very clear that he discusses what cases he has pending with Judge Goldman. And Judge Goldman, in his testimony, reflected that Larner would seek out his,
if Goldman didn't remember, why was it prejudicial? Why was he biased if he didn't recall? If he didn't recall talking about it, so didn't recall any outside facts, then was there an actual impropriety and bias in his sitting, or was it just a possible appearance which caused him to recuse?
I mean, I think it's both. I mean, I really do. I think there's an appearance, because certainly Mr. Larner is giving a skewed view of Vincent McFadden to Judge Goldman when he's talking to him. And whether Judge Goldman recognizes that when he's ruling or not, that's got to be lingering there with him in how he goes about handling matters involving Vincent McFadden, because he's gotten this perspective from the prosecutor who's tried the two capital cases and also did the post-conviction action on the assault case. So he's getting that perspective from the prosecutor.
Did Larner actually testify that Goldman admitted to him that he had learned facts of McFadden's cases from Larner?
That is Larner's testimony, and I've provided transcript references to Larner's deposition testimony. He says exactly that. They probably discussed the facts of those cases.
He says probably, you're saying. Not that Goldman said,
no,
I remember specifically. That's
okay.
Very different.
And he also said Goldman had told Larner that Goldman disqualified himself because he learned the facts of Vincent's cases. So Larner did testify that Goldman told him that he was getting off the case because he had learned facts. That's Larner's testimony.
About the case.
About the
case. Not just other cases generally, but about
these specific cases. Larner testified that Goldman told him he got off because he had learned things from Larner about Vincent's case.
And what did Goldman testify to?
Goldman testified to the, that he would talk to Larner about cases because Larner would seek out his input and those kinds of things on the case. So those are the kinds of factors that I think enter into play here as to whether or not Judge Goldman can really fairly consider this, conduct the hearing about the juror misconduct here.
Judge Goldman also had at his access the entire transcript of the jury trial, right? So it wasn't like he was learning something about Mr. McFadden that and he didn't know anything else about Mr. McFadden. He could, I don't know if he did, but he could have read the entire transcript from the jury trial and the death penalty proceeding.
Judge, I think it's different to read a trial transcript and have the prosecutor who's trying these cases and has tried them giving you that prosecutor's perspective. I mean, it's going to be such a skewed view of Vincent McFadden that, you know, is not in conformance with what Vincent McFadden's attorneys would believe. And I think that's the problem. The prosecutor is creating, you know, these kinds of perceptions about Vincent McFadden. It's not like he's saying good things about Vincent McFadden. I'm sure he's saying things that are harmful to Vincent McFadden and also strategically are harmful to Vincent McFadden. It's not like he's providing anything good about. So that's the perspective that Judge Goldman is going to be receiving information about Vincent McFadden from. That's the perspective he's going to be operating from, having heard from Mr. Larner. In terms of the scope of the hearing that was requested, if you look at, and I've quoted from the transcript of the motion before Judge Goldman, it sets forth, counsel says, we have narrowed our request to the jurors who sat and the alternates. Now, the subsequent pleadings basically sort of reproduce those pleadings and add to them, but the bottom line is, at that hearing, counsel said to the court, we've narrowed our request to the jurors who sat and the alternates. We're not looking to do the entire veneer. And a party can always narrow the relief that they're wanting. They just can't expand it. And that's what counsel did. And in fact, you know, when we look at presumptions here, I think we have to look at, it should be presumed that Vincent McFadden gets to question all the jurors who served, because that is the only way we can get to the truth and the bottom of whether Williams had access to information that he had. He clearly was given information about the assault case and whether he shared that with others or whether,
you know,
it influenced him.
If we had evidence that Williams had talked to some of the jurors and or had shared things and you want to know the effect on the jurors, I'd understand that. But here we have no indication he remembered or shared anything. Why would you need to I mean, it would be an absolute rule in every case if we adopted it here.
I don't think so, Judge, because I think the problem here is that you have to believe Williams' testimony, and that should be done by a judge who hasn't disqualified himself because he's talked to the prosecutor about Vincent McFadden. I think that is the fundamental problem, is that you have a judge who talked to the prosecutor about Vincent McFadden, and that knowledge was not based upon anything the judge got from this particular case. So this judge is making a credibility finding about Williams, and that should not be given deference or deferred to in any way, shape, or form.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'd ask that the court reverse.